The following is a fourth-hand production.
They say I'm disturbed.
From city to city, an incredible hysterical panic spread.
I think we're getting into a weird area here.
Will you tell these fools I'm not crazy? I'm not crazy.
This hysteria.
You can't handle the truth.
His brain is gone.
This is Hysteria 51.
We're here.
The truth is out there.
It's alive.
But you won't find it here.
They're coming for you. Look, there comes one of them now.
Welcome in Hysteria Nation, the podcast that believes the only good airplane to hijack is Con Air. This is Hysteria 51.
Stewardess, what's the in-flight movie today?
We got the plane, man!
Welcome to Con Air.
Broadcasting from the lower fourth dimension, otherwise known as Chicago, I'm one of your captains on this flight to nowhere. My name is John Goforth. Alongside is my co-captain, Mr. Brent Cameron Poe Hand.
You gonna lower yours?
Sorry, boss, but there's only two men I trust. One of them's me. The other's not you.
I'm really glad we had the opportunity to involve Nicolas Cage in this week's show. It's been way too long, John.
Good call, baby doll.
I couldn't agree more.
Not long enough, if you ask me.
That other cranky voice you just heard is the show's head researcher and biggest insurance liability, Conspiracy Bot. C-Bot, what's your problem with Nicolas Cage?
Last time he was on the show, he told me if I ever spoke to him again, he would melt me down to slag and turn me into a hoverboard for Kal-El.
Well, that's aggressive. What'd you say to him?
That I'd rather be melted down to slag and turned into a hoverboard for Kal-El than watch one more of his newer movies. Have you seen these things? They're awful.
What? He's got a point there, John.
Can't argue with you. Listen, there have been some real bombs as of late for old Mr. Cage.
There was some bombs real early, too. Remember the vampire movie he did where he was like,
oh,
going fucking
God, that was... That was absolutely dreadful. Like, didn't he recently have like a Rapture movie too?
Oh yeah, he redid the Left Behind movies. Yeah, where he was on a plane or whatever. Yeah, he was a pilot. Maybe, I don't know. Didn't watch him.
One of his lower budget flicks that I did enjoy from a few years back. Did you ever see Knowing?
No.
So basically, he could see like 5 seconds into the future. So obviously he couldn't predict things because that's not enough time, but you know, you can dodge a bullet, yeah. You know, things like that. But I think my favorite Nick Cage movie, I don't know if it's my favorite, one of the best that nobody talks about is Snake Eyes.
Well, you know what? I think we have met our quota on Nick Cage for the week here.
Especially with all the awful movies lately.
Not to mention Captain Curley's violin.
And on that note, we're going to get all the way past Nick Cage and the IMDb portion of this show and say hello to our guest.
What is up, Mike Gonzalez?
Welcome, Mike Gonzalez, to the show. Everybody's favorite playwright, author, Renaissance man.
Follow up to a Nick Cage discussion? Yeah.
Happy to be back, guys. How's it going?
Real good. You've been busy, we hear, with a little thing called Larkspur. Why don't you tell us about it?
Wow! Here we go, ready or not. The following content is sure to be hot. The information we'd like to present. Now it's time for another segment.
My podcast is called Larkspur Underground, which we'll be eventually releasing at some point.
It's called Underground, so you know it's got a lot of street cred. That's awesome.
Yeah, you know, we're still recording. We're almost there. It's going to be a really cool, spooky, kind of a serial killer mystery thing that I think a lot of people are going to like. If you like Silence of the Lambs, and if you liked the Serial podcast on NPR, it's kind of right in those alleys.
Now, I hear you branch out for some badass voice talent in this one. Hotel workers and then locals and things like that. Just some real badass fellas.
I think people are going to hear some voices that they know and or love.
At least know.
Not so much trust, yeah. But no.
but you mentioned you likened it to Silence of the Lambs or Serial. This is a narrative fiction podcast, right?
Yeah. So it's kind of like almost like a radio drama. It's, kind of NPR style. The host of the show is working to solve this mystery about this brutal serial killer. So, you know, when you listen to it, it sounds like you are listening to an actual real NPR podcast. That's what I'm hoping, you know, aside from the millions of listeners here that just heard me give that away, I'm hoping everyone else that hears it, you know, has to question reality a little bit.
That sounds awesome. That sounds awesome. I love kind of suspension of disbelief stuff. That'll be fun.
Anywhere where I can hear myself. That's why I play our show repeat nonstop. Now I can throw on some Larkspur Underground too.
So that's what you were hinting at when you said voices they know, because no one at home picked up on that. Thank you for clearing that up.
Hey, you know what I got to say is whenever this comes out, one of the best places to probably listen to this on is going to be Castbox, John.
Castbox. How's my
that
favorite
for a
podcast.
Segue?
Oh, you're back to segues. Well done. Castbox FM. Go to castbox.fm to listen on your desktop or download the app.
iOS, Android, it's all there. It's the orange one, the new app, the orange one, over 5 million downloads, and they can listen and like and review every episode of Hysteria 51 on there, John, each individual episode.
Maybe we'll let them go ahead and listen to Larkspur Underground when it comes out, but for now, just Hysteria 51.
That's right. That's right. It's the only thing you need in life is Hysteria 51 and maybe some Larkspur one day.
So if you're shopping for a new app to listen to all your favorite podcasts on, make sure and check out Castbox in the App Store on iOS, Android, anywhere fine apps are sold.
There you go.
Although it's free.
So we got that out of the way. Seba, what are we talking about tonight?
Tonight we talk about a smooth cat named D.B. Cooper.
How'd you pick that?
I dig anyone who drinks on the job and makes off with a bunch of cash.
Well, I mean, we don't know that he got away, right? That's the whole thing of it.
But everyone's certain that he was drinking on the job.
No, that's true. That's true. All right. So since we're doing a little DB Cooper, John, why don't you hit us with a Gofopedia on it and give everyone a little background to Mr. DB Cooper, which has to be his name because that's what they say.
That's what they say.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
And our thanks, citizensleuths.com, for a lot of tonight's info. Great resource for all things DB Cooper. One afternoon, a day before Thanksgiving in 1971, a guy calling himself Dan Cooper, the media mistakenly called him D.B. Cooper, boarded Northwest Airlines flight number 305 in Portland, bound for Seattle. He was wearing a dark suit and a black tie and was described as a business executive type. While in the air, he opened his briefcase, showing a bomb to the flight attendant and hijacked the plane. The plane landed.
Back in the good old days when you could just take a bomb on a plane. Thanks a lot, Obama.
The plane landed in Seattle, where he demanded $200K in cash, four parachutes, and food for the crew before releasing all the passengers. Also back in the day when hijackers were polite.
Yeah.
We need you to eat. With only three pilots and one attendant left on board, they took off from Seattle with the marked bills, heading south while it was dark and lightly raining. In the 45 minutes after takeoff, Cooper sent the flight attendant to the cockpit while donning the parachute, tied the bag full of money to himself, lowered the rear stairs, and somewhere north of Portland, he jumped into the night. When the plane landed with the stairs down, they found the two remaining parachutes, and on the seat Cooper was sitting in, a black tie. The military was called in days after the hijacking, and approximately 1,000 troops searched the suspected jump zone on foot and in helicopters. The Boeing 727 used in the hijacking was flown out over the ocean, and stairs were lowered and weights dropped in an attempt to determine when Cooper jumped. The SR-71 super secret spy plane was even sent in to photograph the entire flight path. But no sign of D.B. Cooper was ever discovered. The mystery remains unsolved to this day.
Dun, dun, dun! Don't play that, see, but I got it.
Oh, and yours was much better.
What a fun story. Like, who hasn't, like, listened to this and... It's one of those things where you're kind of rooting for the bad guy.
Yeah, well, because he's sharp-dressed, he's nice, he's drinking bourbon. What's not to like? It's the only unsolved hijacking in the history of U.S. aviation.
That speaks volumes for the guy. And I like that he was kicked back and said, you know what? Give me a bourbon and soda. So John and I were prepared for this. And if you look back on it, some people say he was drinking a bourbon and soda like Coke. So John is drinking a bourbon and Coke, and I'm drinking a bourbon and 7-Up because some people say he was drinking a bourbon and 7-Up. So
regardless, our bases are covered.
We're covering all our bases. And Mike,
and that's the only reason we're
drinking. Mike, we told him not to drink because we don't know how we're going to be by the end of the show.
So the problem is, like, I'm just drinking a Pepsi because that's what actor D.B. Sweeney would have drank, and that's what Conspiracy Bot told me we were talking about today. So, I'm like... ill-prepared. I had all my Harsh Realm trivia queued up and ready to go.
You watched Fire in the Sky.
I was going to say, you're tying back to our Travis Walton episode.
I'm going to do my best to keep up with D.B. Cooper here, this polite terrorist.
I say good day, madam.
Yes.
All right, so let's get into the history. Let's start with the hijacking. So it's on the eve of Thanksgiving, November 24th, 1971. November 24th happens to be my birthday, gentlemen. And the 70s is the decade I was born in. I think it was just an early birthday present. Yeah,
something awful happened in the early 70s and in the late 70s.
So as we said, a man carrying a black briefcase approached the flight counter of Northwest Orient Airlines on Portland International Airport.
That's racist.
He identified himself as Dan Cooper, not DB, and purchased a one-way ticket on flight 305, a 30-minute trip to Seattle with cash.
A question, was the show Hanging with Mr. Cooper actually about this hijack?
It's like the subtle nod to it. You had to really pay attention.
The original title is Hanging Off the Rear Steps of an Airplane with Mr. Cooper.
So Cooper boarded the aircraft, a Boeing 727-100, and took seat 18E, maybe, in the rear of the passenger cabin.
The reason Brent says maybe here, because even if you look on Wikipedia, which this actually is not from this time, but
you're welcome.
If you look even on Wikipedia, it says 18E or maybe 18C or maybe 17F. Like they have like three different.
Which seems really weird.
Like, yeah. Didn't they go pull the ticket stub that day? Like, hey, what did his signature look like?
And you know this is the 70s because they say he lit a cigarette and ordered that bourbon and soda and relaxed. This cat seemed like he knew what he was doing. And everyone that they've talked to about this said at no point did he seem razzled, flustered, anything. He was just like, hey, toots, I got something for you here.
How is it they can remember? They said he had 8 cigarettes. They can remember the exact number of cigarettes he had. But they can't actually I just thought of it. They counted the cigarette butts, didn't they?
Yeah,
you
probably.
You don't throw them out those windows.
Yep.
Moving on.
So eyewitnesses on board recalled a man in his mid-40s, between 5'10" and 6 foot tall. Said he was like 170, 180 pounds, and he wore a black lightweight raincoat, loafers, and a dark suit, and a neatly pressed white-colored shirt, a black necktie, and a mother-of-pearl tie pin. And I say that because there is a lot of people that saw him and they were all spot on. Like they spent a lot of time, even the flight attendants, a lot of time with this guy. And they are pretty sure that everything they said as far as the description is spot on.
Feels like an action movie about a Mormon missionary almost at this point. You know,
Elder Cooper and the flight of destiny.
Well, we don't know if he took his jacket off, so we don't know if it was a short sleeve pressed white shirt or a long sleeve. If it was long sleeve,
true.
It's more Men in Blackish.
Did they decide if he actually jumped out over the temple because he was late for his own wedding? Like, I finally got the money, I can afford it. It's fucking expensive for Mormons to get married in the temple.
Or maybe they couldn't find him because he was a man in black.
You got to understand. You got to understand something.
I was just giving Conspiracy about another chance.
Of course. All of my Mormon knowledge comes from the movie Orgasmo. So you got to take it with a grain of salt. So shortly after takeoff, and again, this is a 30-minute flight, Cooper handed a note to the flight attendant, and her name was Florence Schaffner. And Florence, assuming the note contained dude's, hey, here's my number, call me, she just drops it in her purse and keeps on going.
I'll call him later.
Yeah, Cooper leans to her and says, miss, you better look at that note. I have a bomb.
Oh, is that what you're referring to, that thing in your pants now?
Exactly. I was going to say, she just thought that was more of the same, you know.
Here we go.
No, miss, an actual bomb. No, I get it. You have a large penis. No, I'm going to blow up the plane.
But I do have a big dick. I swear. I do. Never mind. Yeah.
Can I have another bourbon?
So the note was printed in all capital letters. It's neat, and its exact wording is unknown. Because Cooper later reclaimed it, but Schaffner recalled that it indicated he had a bomb in his briefcase and directed her to sit beside him. And she did as requested, and then quietly she says, hey, let me see that bomb, motherfucker. And Cooper cracked his brief open long enough to show her what looked like there was some red sticks and wiring in there. It looked to be a bomb.
Until this point, it sounded exactly like the opening to a 70s porno about a plane hijacking.
There's a hole in the bottom of the briefcase. I'll show you the bomb.
Exactly. Reach in here and defuse it.
It was actually such a fake bomb. You open it up, the timer was one of those big old brass alarm clocks.
Yep.
Yeah.
So he closed it. He dictated the demands, $200,000 in negotiable American currency. He wanted $20 bills only.
That's in quotes, negotiable American currency. And people make a big deal out of that because when they're trying to figure out who D.B. Cooper might have been, there's supposition that he might not have been from this country because an American wouldn't call it American currency, probably. They would just say, give me money. But if they're from another country, they might say, now that is complete guesswork, but that is a, that's why it's noted.
Vivant the money, Schaffner. Vivant the money, Lebowski. So,
and up to this point, he's been exceedingly polite, so he could be Canadian.
That is true.
Close to the border.
I'm really sorry that I have to do this. Sorry. Sorry. My bad. Sorry. So then he wants four.
But don't worry. If anyone gets hurt, we've got free healthcare up there.
Then he wants four parachutes, two primary and two reserve, and a fuel truck standing in Seattle to refuel the plane upon arrival. So the stewardess conveyed Cooper's instructions to the pilots in the cockpit, and when she returned, he was wearing dark sunglasses. This dude just gets cooler and more badass. Like, he sounds like some, like, 1970s, I guess, noir guy. He's drinking his bourbon, he throws his shades on, he's like, explosion time.
He said he actually wears his sunglasses at night so he can. So he can. Yeah.
It makes sense. Makes sense.
Just stop.
So the aircraft circled Puget Sound for approximately 2 hours to allow Seattle police and the FBI long enough to get his demands, which unfortunately wasn't like Airheads where he wanted a football helmet full of cottage cheese and naked pictures of B. Arthur. He just wanted money and refueling.
Friend of the show, Bob Fesco, would like naked pictures of B. Arthur. He swears that she's a hot woman.
Well, not anymore. You know, maybe since death, but, you know, maybe. So, and they also, they mobilized.
Literally not hot, cold.
Well, room temperature. Emergency personnel. So then Schaffner recalled that Cooper appeared familiar with the local terrain. And this is interesting. He, like, looks out the window and he's like, looks like Tacoma down there as the aircraft flew above it. And he also correctly mentioned that McCord Air Force Base was only a 20-minute drive, probably at that time, probably takes a little bit longer now, from Seattle Tacoma Airport. And Schaffner described him as calm, polite, well-spoken, and not at all consistent with the stereotypes, the enraged, hardened criminals or take me to Cuba political types that were popular with air piracy at the time. I'm going to say that again, air piracy. He was an air pirate. That's just badass.
I see a
right
white
there.
Guy does it, and it's air piracy. Brown people do it. It's terrorism. I see how this works.
Can we start referring to you as our resident brown person? Because then we could just have you say,
yeah.
Our resident brown person, Mike Gonzalez.
We're going to have him say things so they don't sound racist. That's right. That's how you get away with it.
Our man in the street. Tina Mucklow, another flight attendant, agreed he wasn't nervous, and she told investigator he seemed rather nice. He was never cruel or nasty. He was even thoughtful.
You'll be saying wow every time you use this towel.
He ordered a second bourbon, paid his tab, attempted to tip Schaffner with the change, and offered to request meals for the flight crew when they got to Seattle. I'm thinking, like you said, this cat's Canadian.
Well, and maybe that's why they call it a pirate rather than a terrorist. Terrorists don't request flight meals. That's all I'm saying.
So FBI agents assembled the ransom money from several Seattle banks, which is 10,000 unmarked $20 bills. But
because he asked for them in $20 bills,
they made microfilm photograph of each of them so that they had the serial number.
How did they have time when he only had a half
crazy,
hour?
Right?
Like, that's a lot of pictures.
Well, they circled for 2 hours. They circled Puget Sound for 2 hours while they were getting everything ready.
Still a lot, especially with 1971.
Maybe it's rolling and they're just rolling them in front of it and then they're I don't know. Yeah. I don't know.
Sucks to be an intern that day. That's all I know.
The Cooper rejected the military issue parachutes offered by McCord Air Force Base, demanding instead civilian parachutes with manually operated ripcords. And Seattle police obtained them from a local skydiving school.
He kind of thought that, I don't know what would make one safer than the other. He thought that they might have booby-trapped the first set,
yeah,
but they could have done that to the second set, so I have no idea where that thought process comes from.
And that falls
well,
into...
Actually, I say that that's actually supposition on what he thought, because no one's actually interviewed him to say that.
Well, and we'll talk about the parachutes later, and there is thought process for each reason of why he might have chose one or the
right,
other.
Right, right, right.
So he lets the passengers go. At 5:24, Cooper is informed that his demand has been met, and by 5:39, the aircraft lands in Seattle-Tacoma Airport, and the delivery's completed. Cooper permits all the passengers, Schaffner, and the senior flight attendants to leave the plane. So, like you said, it's just him and, like, the three airline personnel. During a fueling, Cooper outlined his flight plan to the cockpit crew, southeast course towards Mexico City at a minimum airspeed possible without stalling the aircraft.
You boys like Mexico!
Approximately 100 knots. 190 kilometers or 120 miles per hour at a maximum of 10,000 feet altitude. So as low and as slow as you, low and slow to Mexico.
Side note on my little outburst there.
Yeah.
Obviously a reference to Super Troopers.
Of course.
They just finished Super Troopers 2.
Yeah. I saw them. They're editing and it's in the big swing. Yeah.
I can't wait. Out.
So he further specified that the landing gear remained deployed into takeoff landing position. Wings flaps be lowered 15 degrees and the cabin remain unpressurized, which we now know why. He wanted to open the fucking door. Finally, Cooper directed them that the plane take off with the rear exit door open and its staircase extended. Northwest Home Office objected on the grounds it was unsafe to take off with the staircase deployed. So Cooper countered with, fuck it, it is fine, but whatever, I'll lower it myself in the air.
Another point towards him perhaps being Canadian. That's very polite. Most hijackers don't go, you know what, I disagree, but hey, I'll go with your side of things and take care of it myself later.
So he's back in the air at approximately 7:40 p.m., and pilot Scott and the flight attendant Maclow and co-pilot Ratzak, I think is how you say it.
Ratzak,
and flight engineer H.E. Anderson aboard. They take Cooper. Cooper tells Maclow, go in the cockpit, join them, close the door, leave me alone.
Nothing to see here.
Yeah. So she complied, and then she observed Cooper tying something around his waist, and at approximately 8 p.m., a warning light flashed in the cockpit that the aft stairs, the rear stairs, had been activated. So he's opened the door, and the stairs are going down.
And at that very moment, Lloyd Bridges was sitting somewhere saying, I picked the wrong day to quit sniffing glue.
So the crew offered assistance through the intercom system, saying, hey, dude, the fucking door is opening up. You need help? But he refused. Huh? I'm good. And they noticed a change in air pressure then, that he'd opened the fucking door and shit's going down.
If I open the studio door, will it bring this shit show to a halt?
Only he wishes, John.
Yeah, exactly.
So at approximately 8:13, the aircraft's tail section sustained a sudden upward movement, sniffing enough to require trimming to bring the plane back to level, meaning someone jumped out. Like there was a bunch of weight. They said about the weight of a 180-pound man with $200,000 strapped to him,
who had taken his tie off,
give or take a few ounces. So they land at Reno Air Force Base. The aft stairs are still deployed. FBI agents, state troopers, sheriff's deputies, and the Reno police surround the jet as they're not yet determined whether he actually jumped or not.
And we actually have our first indication he might not have been Canadian. It's very impolite to not close the door behind
you. That's true. And they find out he's no longer born because they searched the plane with an armed people. He's gone. So now what the fuck happened to him? Well, time to start an investigation. An investigation that I will add ended in 2016 when they said, fuck it, we can't find him. That's a hell of 40-some years.
I think the official release was our resources could be better spent elsewhere.
Yeah. Bravo. Bravo, Mr. Cooper.
Now that we have expended $1.3 billion trying to recover this $200,000.
And 50 years of the government's hard work and time.
Yeah. But they're still entertaining leads. So it's not completely sealed. It's just put to the back of the line.
Well, just know that, Brent, that if you ever go commit a heinous crime, that if after 50 years they haven't figured it out, they might give up on it.
Which is funny. Air piracy only had a statute of limitations of 5 years. So at the end of those 5 years, they actually changed it to like this Hobbs Air Act, which had no statute of limitations, so they could keep looking for him.
But just by the fact that they called it air piracy, don't you think that they're like, oh yeah, that'll happen. Yeah. Just in case there's an air pirate that comes along and wants to take these planes over. Yeah, we'll put 5 years, Earl? Yeah, 5 years.
When you know how everyone dresses up for Pirates of the Caribbean as their favorite pirate, I think we all go as D.B. Cooper. Who are you dressed as? My favorite pirate, D.B. Cooper. Call me Dan.
I'm going to dress up as my favorite pirate from Captain Phillips.
I think you need to do some serious binging and purging to get down to that 112-pound frame of that pirate.
I lose like 12 pounds when I take my belt off. Does that count?
All right, investigation. So aboard the airliner, they recover 66 unidentified latent fingerprints.
Cooper's, what is a latent fingerprint?
I think it's just a fingerprint. That's a fancy way of saying fingerprint.
All right, got it.
Cooper's, now this is maybe, maybe not. Cooper's black necktie and mother of pearl tie clip, and two of the four parachutes, one of which had been opened and two shroud lines been cut because they figure that's what she saw him tie
around the money. Right.
Now, I say maybe his black clip on tie because they're not 100% sure it was his, but it was a black tie. It was a clip on, which comes in later with one of my theories on this.
Which also means that he could be Canadian, because we all know that Canadians can't actually tie ties.
Ties, shoes. I mean, they call it the Velcro Nation for a reason. So,
right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
Eyewitnesses in Portland, Seattle, and Reno, and all of those personally interacted with Cooper were interviewed, and a series of composite sketches were developed. And it's interesting, they interviewed all these people separate, and the composite sketches were spot on the same. It's one of the few times where, like, they were like, everyone kind of had the same story.
Wait, we don't need Jeff Mudgett to show us how the picture might look like something else?
Good old Jeff Mudgett. I hear him and David Weiss are getting a flat together somewhere. They're going to be roommates.
They mud together. They enjoy a good mudding.
Is that like that scene in Ghost where one of them's just behind the other, like,
oh,
forming?
Oh, my love, my darling.
I apologize.
Mudding is where you go sit in a big vat of mud with, like, cucumbers on your eyes.
Oh.
It's good for your exfoliation.
I don't know.
I don't really even know what that means, but yeah, we'll go for it.
So, like I said, they made these sketches, and a precise search of the area was difficult to find because they don't know when he jumped, at what altitude, anything, because there was no set aviation plan. They said, take me to Mexico. So the pilot's like, all right, I'll go this way.
While it is amazing that he hasn't been found to this day, don't you also get the feeling that even back then, investigations were kind of like playing a game of Mad Libs? All right, give me a noun.
You say that every time the police are involved. At what date does that change?
3 years ago.
I just wondered. The year 2008. Those Keystone fuck-ups.
Well, we went out into the forest and we looked. Guess he got away.
Right. So I guess the big thing that when they're trying to figure out where he might have jumped at, an important variable was the length of time he remained in free fall before pulling his ripcord. If he did succeed in opening the parachute at all, they don't know. You know, 200 mile an hour wind, he's in loafers, you know, so and a business suit.
And
so,
you can't even get a straight answer from, you know, quote unquote experts on
a lot of people say if you jump out of that, he's dead.
And then a lot of other people saying if you've jumped more than twice in your life, no problem.
So I was listening to the FBI, the head of the FBI investigation on him. He said there is no way you can survive jumping out of that plane. Then the same documentary went to a flight school and they do the DB Cooper jump where they have a 727 and they do the exact fucking jump he did. And the guy's like, that's not true. Let's go. Like, and they do it.
My grandmother, Edna, she did it last week.
I shit you not. Now, of course, at the time when DB Cooper did it, it was overcast and it might may or may not have been raining depending on where he went. But to say that was an impossible jump is horse shit. And it's such horse shit, you can recreate the jump yourself after you've done a few jumps. And people think that he had no experience. No, he was a paratrooper from the military. Who knows? You know, but it's definitely a survivable jump.
If you've planned it out this well, you have to think, even if you weren't a experienced paratrooper, that you at the very least would have taken a few practice jumps just to make sure you knew how to do it.
Right. Right.
John, have you ever jumped out of an airplane?
No, I never have. I've never gone skydiving.
I'll pay for you to do the DB Cooper jump as your first time.
You know, I kind of like his way of thinking, John. I'm with him on this one.
I feel like he's implying something there.
He'll stand with a bucket on the bottom. I got you.
Come on down.
So this reports place Cooper's landing zone within the area of the southernmost outreach of Mount St. Helens, a few miles southeast of Ariel, Washington, near Lake Merwin. But no trace of Cooper nor any of the equipment presumed to have left the aircraft with him was found at all during the initial search. The FBI also coordinated with aerial search and thorough ground search. Ultimately, the search operation, arguably the most extensive and expensive in U.S. history, uncovered no significant material evidence relating to the hijacking. They used the fucking SR-71 Blackbird with the most sophisticated camera system on Earth and found nothing. It's like that thing in Predator, we hit nothing. Like they just got nothing. They came up empty.
I wonder why, if they know that he dove out in Washington, like, why did the plane have to go all the way to Reno? And like, that's quite a trip to figure out.
I think what they said is they think he did, but when they found nothing there, they're like, well, maybe something else happened. So they retrace as much of it as they could.
I guess they don't know for sure when he jumped. It was open for a long time. And once she was in the back, I'm not going to do the math, but the amount of miles that you could cover in 10 to 15 minutes going that fast.
And also the amount of time that he waited to pull his ripcord while moving that fast covers a vast area of, that he would have settled down
and
in.
And they said it might have been raining. I mean, those stairs were probably slick. What if as soon as he lowered it and they shut the door, he slips, falls, hit his head, and just goes down? He's done.
Yeah. It's crazy. Like you said, a minute here and a minute there, even though they're going really slow, changes everything drastically. And the height altitude, they didn't keep a steady altitude. They kept up and down.
This is why you need altimeters. How many times do I need to say it on this podcast?
Come full circle.
So then we got a portion of Brian Ingram's 1980 discovery. So in February 1980, 9 years after the incident, 8-year-old Brian Ingram vacationed with his family on the Columbia River at a beachfront known as Tina Bar, uncovered 3 packets of the ransom cash as he raked the sandy riverbank to build a campfire. That's fucking crazy. The bills were significantly disintegrated. You could look them up and it's just like the middles of them left.
I just enjoy the fact that Brian's parents were like, hey, we've got an 8-year-old. Go get us the shit for a campfire. Right?
But this money was still bundled in rubber bands. And FBI technicians confirmed that the money was indeed portion of the ransom. So there's 2 packets.
Yeah, because the serial numbers were still visible.
Exactly. 2 packets of $120 bills each and a 3rd packet of 90, all arranged in the same order, which was given to Cooper. To date, none of the other 9,710 remaining bills have turned up anywhere in the world. Their serial numbers remain available online. Public search. You can look it up. This is the only time anything has ever come up. And they searched that motherfucking area, that Tina Bar, like crazy to find the rest of the money because they thought maybe it followed from the river down into there. Nothing. Like he was like, whoops, as he maybe was in the air or something. Who knows?
Now, my conspiracy theory is he lands in the middle of the Washington Forest because we have 2 packets with $120 bills. One of them only has 90.
Mm-hmm.
So he lands in the middle of a Sasquatch encampment. And he's like, hey, who wants to make a quick $20 to get me out of the woods right now?
Who wants to make $20 the hard way?
That's right. And since Sasquatch don't really understand our currency, this is actually enough money to buy an entire state.
It's like, fuck you.
Exactly.
It's like in a Euro trip where he tips him a nickel. A nickel? A fucking nickel? And he slaps his boss. Fuck you. I buy my own hotel. In their Eastern Bloc countries. So the overarching debate on this whole thing is, did he die or did he land and get away scot-free, one might say. So it's a huge public debate. Like I said, experienced skydivers say he would have died at first if he hadn't jumped. Other experienced skydivers say, fucking if he was expert, no problem at all. One experienced parachutist believed that anyone who had 6 or 7 jumps, as John attested to earlier, could accomplish the jump, no problem. The cold weather may not have killed him in the woods if he landed. It was cold, but it wasn't fucking terrible.
I actually said 1 to 2 jumps, but I was affording for the fact that he was Canadian, and they're better skydivers.
There you go. No body or parachute has ever been found. So the FBI says you couldn't have survived it. Great. Where's he hanging from a tree dead? Where did that happen? Where's it at?
That's where Mike steps in. The Sasquatch just took his body.
That's true.
Yeah.
So if he was to survive, they say he has to have been an experienced skydiver.
So there's arguments for and arguments against, right? That he might have been an experienced skydiver.
So he requested front and back parachutes. That sounds like a novice. You don't know what you're doing. He turned down instructions how to use the parachutes. Kind of sounds experienced. He picked the non-steerable military parachute. Novice. Why would you do that?
But the military chute could be better to withstand the exit speed of that plane, which might make him experienced.
Then he put the parachute on like he knew what he was doing, experienced. And he took the reserve chute that was sewn closed and non-functional. Well, that sounds like a novice. Unless he was wanting that because he knew he was going on the ground, and maybe he was going to open that up and use it for coverage in camp. You know, wise, easy way to use that chute to cover yourself when it's cold outside.
It turns out he can only sleep well if he's swaddled like a newborn, and he was going to swaddle himself in the unopened chute.
So then we got the Palmer Report. That stemmed from the FBI briefing in Portland State University, where geologist Dr. Leonard Palmer was asked to analyze the sandbar where the money was found, the money found in 1980. And in between 1971, the hijacking, and in 1980 when the money was found, the Columbia River was dredged and sand was deposited at Tina Bar in 1974. So Palmer's report determined that the money was on a layer of top sand laid down by the dredging. This implied that the money was somewhere else upstream for years before coming to rest on Tina Bar. So the counterpoint was that the delicate rubber bands that were still intact on the bundles were found. The bands pointed to an earlier time frame for the money coming to rest.
People were saying that if it was dredged, those very delicate rubber bands would have snapped.
I said that in a weird way. Yeah. They're saying this was dredged. Well, if it was dredged, it was going to be knocked the fuck out. I can't imagine that they would have stayed together, because it doesn't take long for a rubber band to go. You put it outside and it becomes brittle as fuck.
But there's a million eventualities there. What if it was already caked in mud and mud was acting as a barrier around it? So it just went as one big, big lump of mud, essentially, when it got dredged.
That's true. So when was where was the real flight path? So the flight path on the...
That was like the first time, folks, in the history of doing this show that he looked at me and didn't give me a "you're an idiot" look.
Well, you're learning, John. You're learning.
I still think you're an idiot.
Thanks, C-Bot. Appreciate that.
So where was the real flight path? Well, the flight path map in the FBI archives has no information on who drew the flight path or where it was created. Gotta love fucking record keeping.
Was I wrong? Keystone Cops.
The flight path as drawn is thought to be from a detailed analysis of radar data and flight recorder discussed in the FBI transcripts. But the FBI path does not fly over Tina Bar or the Washougal area at all. The money found on Tina Bar forces the flight path debate, because it would be much easier to explain the money found if Cooper flew over Tina Bar and jumped, or Flight 305 flew over the Washougal River and Cooper's ransom money ended up washing downstream. So a lot of people say that motherfucker was traipsing through the area and lost it out of his pocket or something. Not his pocket, but his pouch.
And if that sounds confusing, it's because it is. If you look it up online, that there's the supposed flight path and there's like 30 other supposed flight paths. They truly weren't exactly sure of the flight path.
This is a time pre-GPS where it's not being recorded at all times.
Right.
So then you got to look at Cooper and say, well, was he from the area? He's sitting in the airplane and he recognized Tacoma from the air. Sounds like he's local. But if he was a local, he'd be an idiot to hijack an airplane where he could be recognized. So that sounds like he's not local. But he made very unusual requests for negotiable American currency, as John alluded to. So unlike most Americans, it sounds like he's from outside of the country. That's the story in a nutshell. And they don't know anything else, pretty much. I don't know. What are you thinking, Mike?
I don't know. I'm wondering, there's so many different things that could happen. Like, you know, did his chute fail to open? Maybe he just like was like a lawn dart straight into the soft riverbed, and that's where the money came from. Yeah, exactly. It's got a Wile E. Coyote shaped little like imprint of D.B. Cooper out there somewhere.
Bring me the Acme parachute.
There you go. Yeah. He pulled the ripcord and that anvil floated out, so he had to do that double take to the camera and wave bye-bye and, you know, and big puff of smoke.
And while we don't know for sure what happened that day, there has been some new evidence since then. And when we come back, we are going to talk about that evidence and how it relates to the clip-on tie we've talked so much about. Next on Hysteria 51.
David, me amo Brent.
Bonjour, Brent. Je m'appelle David.
You didn't do Spanish. I thought if we were going to do this together, we'd do the same language.
Oh, sorry.
that's on brand for us.
I just thought romance languages was the key.
Everything I say is romantic, and that is thanks to Rosetta Stone. You guys, we've been touting these things forever. We love Rosetta Stone, and we actually are users. David, you've really been using it even for longer than I. What's your experience been like?
Oh, it's been great. The thing is, you really get to learn how to speak and think in that language with it. So it's very high on pronunciation too. So you can, you know, learn how to speak.
And you know, our show is all about proper pronunciation.
In that pronunciation. Yeah, that's right. But they design it for long-term retention, you know, if you don't get the pronunciation right, you say it until you do. And then, you know, that just seeps into your head.
Well, and that's why, you know, this has been trusted by experts for 30 years, and there's over 25 different languages that you can learn, and people, millions and millions of users use it because, like you said, it does seep in and you're using it with, you know, you get speech recognition and mm-hmm. it hears you. You get to use like the built-in true accent features that gives you this pronunciation, which is super convenient, and you can do it at your own time. And I don't know if you know this, but I'm all about value, and you get a one-time purchase, 25 languages. If I learned all 25 languages, I'd be so confused or really cool. I'd go in and out.
But you'd be real marketable.
But literally, though, this is something that we use, and both of us have given the seal of approval because we want to do this long-term, and it's something that it works. You know, and we don't do long-term stuff like this. And this is the one that we've chosen, and we love it. So all you guys got to do, don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now, as we've told you 1,000 times, and it's always now. Right now. Get started. For very limited time, Hysteria 51 listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off.
How much?
50%. Visit RosettaStone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your unnatural life.
Wow.
Redeem, redeem, redeem. How do they do it?
Rachete, you're 50% off. Rachete. Redeem it. 50% off. RosettaStone.com/today. Do it today. After years of fine print contracts and getting ripped off by overpriced wireless providers, if we've learned anything, it's that there's always a catch. So when Brent and I heard that for a limited time, all Mint Mobile wireless plans are $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan, we thought, man, what's the catch? But after talking to them, it all made sense. There isn't one. Mint Mobile's secret sauce is that they sell wireless service online. They cut out the cost of retail stores and pass those sweet savings directly to you. Brent is trying a plan right now and says that it works like a charm from Chicago to Nashville as he makes his big old move. Mint Mobile is working for him. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. And you can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all your existing contacts. So ditch the overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's limited time deal and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/hysteria. That's mintmobile, mintmobile.com/hysteria, hysteria. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/hysteria. $45 upfront payment required. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Welcome back, kids. Hopefully you had time to brush up on your FBI skills, because I think they need your help, is what we're learning from going through a lot of these cases.
Or had time to hit the fast forward button, whatever you did.
One or the other.
We're trying to say if you took 10 minutes to read their Wikipedia page, you're about on par with the FBI agents from the 70s. So,
and ahead of this podcast.
We'll give you special agent denunciation. Yeah, there you go. All right. So we're back. We were just talking about, you know, the whole case is done. Now let's break down some of the finer details. And one of my favorites is the curious case of the clip-on tie. And a lot of people go, "Why, this guy was so smooth, and then he's got a fucking clip-on tie." Some people think he was just a kind of douchey. Some people think that was for a reason. So in the entire Cooper case, the only two real pieces of useful physical evidence currently available is that black tie and the ransom money found in Tina Barr. So while the money points to what it could have happened after Cooper jumped, it's the only the it's only the tie that points to where he came from in his life that he led beforehand. So of all the possible things for him to leave on the plane, the tie was incredibly fortunate when for this investigation.
When you say points to his life beforehand, you're obviously going with Michael's assumption that he was... Was it the Church of Latter-day Saints? No.
He's a Mormon.
A Mormon,
missionary.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Same thing, right?
So a tie is one of the only articles of clothing that isn't washed on a regular basis, and that's a good thing. It picks up dirt and grime just like any other piece of clothing, but that accumulation never truly gets reset, some might say, in the washing machine.
Which I always thought was gross. Like, I wore ties for years in my jobs, and... It's like, yeah, this thing doesn't get washed. I mean, you rub up against stuff all day, and it's
right.
Just, you put it back on, you know, the next week or whatever.
Right? And each of those particles that you're rubbing against on and getting on and putting on week after week comes from something or somewhere, and they can tell a story. And the proper instruments like electron microscope, which are available now, you can really dig in and tell that fucking story.
They certainly do tell a story. Hey, Earl, you just got home. I know you said you worked late. Why is there glitter all over your tie?
I was helping out at the child school. The child school. We don't have any children. Fuck you, Dave.
And
why is he talking to Dave?
I don't know. Why is Dave there? And it smells like cotton candy.
I had sex with a clown. Damn it. Why couldn't you spend with a
you
stripper?
Went to the strip club.
I had sex with a clown. I'm not even upset. I'm impressed. So this black tie was found in the cushion of seat 18E, the seat that Cooper was sitting in, allegedly.
Yeah.
This fact alone should link the tie to Cooper, but has been in general position of the FBI that they don't know if this is Cooper's tie or not, which you got to treat it like that.
Oh, lots of people were wearing black clip-on ties at the time.
But most investigators find that it's reasonable to assume that it belonged to him. So, of course.
So later, like since then,
in
the 2000s.
Well, we're talking about the electron microscope.
We used an electron microscope to take a look.
And the particulate matter identified in the tie represent the only new physical evidence to come along in the case since the money that was found in 1980. So while the age of the case makes it older and a colder, the tools of the investigation have become overwhelmingly, as we stated, more sensitive and sophisticated. So all this new technology can be used to investigate this now, and this is the only fucking piece we have.
And they did. And they found some interesting particulates. They found pieces of titanium.
Yep.
Strontium.
Sulfide. That's a fun one.
Sulfide.
And cerium. Now, why are those important, John?
Well, cerium comes from Syria. And so we mentioned before that he might have been a terrorist.
And strontium sulfide comes from the sovereign nation of strontium. So.
And so he's a terrorist from either strontium or strontia and or Syria.
Now, the real reason why those are so telling is there was literally in 1971 only one place that those three elements were being used, and that was Boeing, the company that manufactures aircraft. They were used there all the time, so you can look at that and say whoever that tie belonged to had to have been in the Boeing plant.
I'd buy that for a dollar.
So that's a telling fucking tale. If this gentleman, it brings up all new avenues. He knew about planes. Well, did he have a background in it? And did he have a background because he was a pilot? Or did the flight crew collude with him and it was an inside job?
Right. And assuming that supposition is true, that it only could have come from Boeing.
Mm-hmm.
Other people have said that there were a handful of plants it could have come from. And, you know.
The believed one is that it's probably
from Boeing.
Yeah.
Also, the fact that it's on his tie means that he was more of an executive there, because if he was a plant worker, he wouldn't have worn his tie onto the...
And here's another thing that I found really interesting with that. The executives a lot of times wore clip-on ties because when they're around machinery, if it got caught, it had to come off so they couldn't get sucked into machinery like that. So that makes sense for I wear a fucking clip-on tie out of safety.
Or he's Canadian.
Nation, we want pictures of your dogs. That's just a personal request from me, but while you look for a good one, let me tell you about something near and dear to mine, Brent's hearts. Your dog's health.
You may have noticed lots of dogs suffering from health issues these days. Joints, odors, it's not good. Actress Katherine Heigl noticed these issues too, and after a ton of research, there was one place she found we can look to support any dog's health. Their food. So she created Superfood Complete, food for your four-legged friend that's made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Her company, Badlands Ranch, also supports the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Now, I know Brent has used Superfood Complete with his lovable meatballs, and they absolutely love it. He said it's easy to prepare, both his guys grow crazy for it, and he loves knowing what he's giving them is healthy and full of ingredients that are actually beneficial to his little rapscallions. You can try it for yourself by going to badlandsranch.com/hysteria and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular priced order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/hysteria today.
So that really narrows this field down. So you'd think, well, he jumps out. You've got a picture of this guy. 1971 Boeing employees, if he worked there, one of them should be able to look at this cat and go, I know that guy.
And, you know, we're not going to get into all of the potential suspects. Every internet sleuth out there has a different potential suspect. There was one guy who's already been debunked who did a similar hijacking a few years later.
And spent the next, like, 40 years in prison for it.
But in reality, it was proven that it was more of like a copycat. He actually said to a buddy at a bar, I could do it better than that D.B. Cooper.
Many people have on their deathbed confessed to being D.B. Cooper.
And even more have said their parents were. Why is that a thing? Why do so many people turn their parents in for being renowned criminals?
Except for when you go to the case of the Zodiac Killer with the one dude in turns in his stepfather and they're like, yeah, maybe.
We don't know if he was the Zodiac Killer, but it's weird that there's a bloody knife.
Yeah.
We don't know what he did.
Mike, how many bloody knives do you have around you right now?
Seven. Right now? I mean,
that's my guess.
You know, dishwasher's running right now.
Fuck, Mike, you ruin everything. You're going to have to find a new brown friend, John.
I don't know. And during this presidency, they're going to be hard to find.
That's true.
Speaking of rare earth commodities.
All right. So some conclusions we're going to try to come to.
There's some conclusions that can be drawn based on what is known.
Go ahead, John.
So first, the FBI flight path map that we talked about, it seems to pass the smell test. Agents working on the flight path in 1971 had the radar and flight path data, which is lost today. The SAGE radar, that's an acronym that I don't know what it means, but we're just going to skip over that. The SAGE radar, used to track Cooper's plane, was relied upon to identify, locate, and track incoming Russian bombers and threats to the United States. So there's no reason to assume that they would get it wrong. I mean,
right.
If they're going to get anything right, it's whether bombers are coming to get us.
One would hope.
You'd hope. Analysis of various features. I mean, that was the middle of the Cold War.
Right.
Was it the middle of the Cold War? Yeah, it was.
Yes.
Analysis of various features of this case rule out the theories that require a different flight path other than the one portrayed on the FBI map. So what we're saying here is, yeah, it could have been this flight path. It could have been that flight path because of the money or because of this or because of that. That based on everything we know, that doesn't make a lot of sense. And the FBI flight path probably makes more sense.
Right.
Lastly, the text descriptions in the FBI 302 link the flight path to various towns. This research finds that the flight path and jump zone are reasonable and should be a cornerstone in the analysis of this case.
Meaning everything that's in front of you should probably be taken, right, you know, for face value. Because
taking all the evidence to bear, it makes sense.
So where is he? Well, if he jumped out and they can't find him, it kind of leads to make you one think maybe he may actually fucking made it.
Sasquatches.
Yeah. So the money find at Tina Bar complicates things, though. The rubber band experiments allow less than a year for the money to become entombed in the sand. Like you said, it had to have been impacted for it to stay. And the money continues
like a molar.
Impacted. The money continues to resist all natural explanations for how it arrived at Tina Bar. like I said, maybe he dropped the shit, you know, but the story behind the money may be as big as the Cooper story itself. There's no hard evidence that Cooper died in the jump. So it remains the primary debate. If Cooper walked out of the woods, there certainly would be easy for it to explain why the money fucking went there. He dropped it. Something happened. Whereas if he just jumped out, there's no fucking way it got there naturally. Probably.
The thing that's hard about this is it's hard to know what nature does.
Right.
Right? Like, right. What were the winds like? What did the river do?
Well, you got to look at it. The earth is flat, as we all know. So there's only so much windswept things that can happen before the firmament, and that's the dome that covers us all, as we know.
So when he jumped, how much higher was the dome?
14 feet.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah.
He was right next to the sun because, not little do you know, he actually was the guy who changes the bulb in the sun. That's why he jumped out at night.
Now, if you're going to change the bulb in the sun, do you need a special key to get out of the dome?
No, they leave it unlocked.
Oh.
Yeah, who cares?
Like Eliza Lamb's water tank.
Yes.
They just leave it unlocked.
Leave that unlocked. Elisa's fine. She's, you know, someone might want to go for a little swim. That brings us to the tie. So the tie.
We make fun of flat earthers and dead Asian women at the same time.
It's range, man.
That actually makes me happy.
But So the tie reasonably belonged to Cooper, as we've said. Probably says. The probability analysis was never done to estimate the likelihood of the black tie found on the plane belonging to him. And this probability analysis shows that it's reasonable to assume that the tie was that of the hitchhiker. The hijacker. I'm sorry, I don't want to say hitchhiker or hijacker. The air pirate.
The air pirate. There you go.
When you say the probability analysis, this comes back to that citizensleuths.com website we were talking about.
Yeah.
That is
who's taken over for the FBI and done better
and
than
done
they
a
did.
Better job. Yeah. It's like some real, it's not just some, you know, some Google hard asses.
Yeah.
It's some real professors and real people that have looked into this stuff. And they ran a probability analysis on the whole thing, all the pros and cons, and they say, yeah, it's a lot more likely that the tie belonged to him than it didn't, which obviously, anecdotally, you could have just said, too, because it was on his seat.
Right. So, this is a crucial first step, since all the particles found in the tie tell a story, for that to be Cooper's story. There needs to be some critical review of the likelihood that the tie belonged to Cooper, and if it did, like we said, fucking go look into
Boeing.
So titanium metal was the rare, exotic, narrowing field of the possibility of D.B. Cooper. It was on him. The titanium particles on the tie, the most dramatic finding in this research. So most of the other metals could have been written off as contamination, too common or anything like that. But additional findings that the titanium was not alloyed further the restrictions on where Cooper could have required these.
Right. So it wasn't raw. It wasn't titanium alloy. It was just hardcore titanium, which is only available in a couple places.
And then you add in those other metals that were on there too, that you don't get from rubbing up on your local Pepsi machine.
And you add in the fact that he was likely an executive, and it narrows down your list of suspects from like millions.
It says Cooper worked at or had access to a plant that used titanium. This fact alone reduces the number of potential suspects from millions down to only a few hundred. That's a big fucking step. So the tie would have been worn by managers, as we said, or engineers in metalworks plants. The spiral aluminum chips are only made by using metalworking machinery. And since they were found on the tie, that suggests that he was either an engineer or a manager who went out on the floor. And the managers, as you said, are engineers, could wear the ties. And it was probably a clip-on because you're around said machinery, sucks it off, you don't die. So that's a whole lot of shebang on this. Mike, a couple questions for you. A, what are your thoughts on the whole deal? And B, do you think this could ever be solved? Will we ever know who Dan Cooper really was?
I have a feeling just like, you know, with Amelia Earhart, when they keep finding these little bits and pieces of evidence every once in a while, I think like, you know, 100 years from now, someone's going to find like a chunk of skeleton or something, you know, out there in the woods and put these pieces together, possibly. I don't know. But I wonder, like, why didn't the FBI...
says this belonged to Dan Cooper.
Exactly. My name's D.B. Cooper. But I wonder, like, since the government had all this time to set up the parachutes, give him the cash, all that stuff, why they didn't put some kind of tracking device in either the bag of cash or the parachutes? I mean, yeah. They had, you know, back in Vietnam, they had these little transmitters that were, like, no joke, designed to look like pieces of dog shit or monkey shit that they would drop out of planes. Here's so that they'd be invisible on 20, the ground.
$20 bills and some monkey shit, sir.
Some monkey shit. Yeah, he'll never
know. Don't ask why. But just, like, take it. No, take it. Take it. Don't ask why. Stop asking. Take it.
But they could have sewn that into the bag or something. You know what right. I mean? You would think they would do something to track, you know, where he landed.
Other than just, you know, taking note of all the serial numbers on the bills.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what are we going to do? Spend, you know, 2 hours taking pictures of money? Or maybe we should think of a way to track. Again, this goes back to the Keystone Cop bullshit that John was talking about. Like, you know, they're worried about tracking individual bills instead of figuring out where the guy is. I mean, that's just not well, smart thinking.
And this isn't the first or the last time that they use serial numbers to try to track stolen money. But the reality is, how many cash transactions take place on a daily or weekly basis mm-hmm. in this country that the banks then they don't make it to a bank? They go from one person to one company to another to another, and it never makes it to a bank. And so no one's recording those serial numbers.
I looked this up. I looked up the answer to this, actually. I'm glad you brought that up. So every denomination has a life expectancy. The paper that they use on hundreds is nowhere near as durable as the paper that they use on dollar bills and such. And so, and I don't remember the time, but like your average $20 bill has a life expectancy of like 8 to 12 years, something like that. And all those bills are returned eventually. The serial numbers are tagged and then they shred them, and they actually use the shredded bills for building materials. They
confetti put it, for the end of concerts.
Similar, but they use it for pin. Like building materials. And so they figured if they were ever put into circulation.
And that is how Trump gets the valuation on all of his buildings. It was made from $1 billion.
And so you look at it like that, though, like this money has never realistically been put into circulation because it would have came back out by now 4 or 5 times over and been cataloged and destroyed. Unless it's sitting in a bank vault somewhere, you know, not a bank vault, but a someone's lockbox or something like that.
I just, well, not my turn yet.
Mike, you did say a skeleton, so you're of the mindset you think he probably died?
Yeah, I mean, you know, all I'm thinking of is, you know, pitch black, getting dumped over. I don't know if you guys or anyone listening, if you have seen aerial shots of the forests out in Washington and Oregon, like, it is just another world. I mean, it is like a black blanket of trees. They're so thick out there that even if he's an experienced jumper, even if he pulls the chute and it works, you know, that at that short altitude or whatever, like, you still either going to have to do this pinpoint landing on a clearing, maybe where there's a stream, which would explain the money. But like, other than that, you're going into trees like Rambo First Blood style, and you're going to be taking a tumble down.
Right.
I just, you know, and then you've got bears and Sasquatch and everything else out there that's going to try to eat you. Like, I don't know. Like, honestly, one of the things, you know, like when you mentioned briefly the conspiracy possibly between like the flight crew and DB Cooper, like maybe they found a way to, you know, decoy, like, oh yeah, he jumped, and then, you know, sneak him off the plane somewhere or something. Like, that's the only way I could see him surviving this
right,
thing.
Because just
the idea.
Yeah,
I mean, the jumping out, you're going to die.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, John, where are you at?
I'm actually on the opposite side of Mike. When I think of DB Cooper, I kind of think like a preliminary version or an early version of like Ocean's 11. I think of this guy was suave. He knew what he was doing. I think this was really well planned. I think if you're a smart person who understands a few things, the way money is circulated, the way... If you do some research, you can figure out how this might, at least in 1971, how this might play out. So you'll know how it'll play out. So you plan for it. You take that flight a few times. You understand where it's going to go. You tell them what flight path you want. I think he jumped out, knew exactly where he was jumping, at what speed he was jumping, because he dictated the speed. He dictated the course. I think he knew about where he'd land. He probably had been there before. I think he landed. I think he probably had a pack or something set up in those woods to help him out. He got, you know, he probably changed, put on some survival gear, got out, you know, probably had a truck or a car set up somewhere, drove somewhere. And my guess is that either he was foreign or he was an American who decided that he wasn't going to live in America anymore. And this was his escape plan. This was his exit. He was a nice enough guy. He was just fed up with whatever he had going on in life and said, here's how I'm getting out of all of it. And so he was a really, really smart, well put together, well thought out dude who, to me, the lack of evidence is the evidence. It's
right.
We couldn't find the money. We couldn't find the parachutes. We couldn't find a body. I joke about them being Keystone Cops, but you've got the full force and brunt of the FBI, along with some help from the military, and you can't find anything.
Right.
In 1971, I think that's pretty surprising. But if he was really well thought out and moved quick and went from point A to point B to point C and had it all planned, I think he got away, and I think he went to a foreign country, and you know, money in a foreign American money spends well in foreign countries, and it doesn't have to go back to the U.S. Mint.
Like 90% of all $100 bills are outside of the U.S.
and they never make it back to the U.S.
Ever,
Mint.
Ever.
That's what I think happened, and I don't know if he's alive to this day because, you know, obviously it's been 50 years. If he was 35 or 40 at the time,
they figured he was in his mid 40s in 71.
Okay, well, so then obviously he's probably passed away by now. That's what I believe happened. I think he was one of the very few successful, well thought out criminals.
In order to,
like Ocean's 11.
In order to,
but I think
go ahead.
I was going to, on that point, I think, you know, he would have had to flee to a foreign country because the only way you're going to be set for life on $200,000 is to get to Mexico or somewhere else where you can stretch that out.
Which is funny because he said take me to Mexico City.
But also, don't forget that $200,000 in 1971 is a lot different than $200,000 today.
True. So here's the thing.
Yeah.
If he did not give the pilot a course. He just said, take me on a southerly course to Mexico City. So that to me tells me one of two things. Either he knew the area so well, he had given someone a range of where I'm going to jump out, or him and the pilot or co-pilot or someone was in on it together. Like you said, this Ocean's 11 shit, which $200,000 isn't a lot of money if you're going to be splitting it up with people. So he either had a whole bunch of people that are going to be in on this $200,000, or he just said, fuck it, and jumped out. Now, the whole idea of him jumping out and not making it, I find incredibly interesting thought process because they never found anything, including flying over there with the fucking Blackbird, thousands of troops, hundreds, if not thousands, of ground people sweeping the area. Nothing was ever found. I don't know if he survived. I don't know anything. I want him to. It's one of those things where you just start rooting for the fucking air pirate. Start going, yeah. I hope.
Well, here's
fucking made it.
Follow-up question for all of us. Do you think the bomb was actually a bomb?
No, not at all.
Mike?
No, I mean, no. If he's genuinely trying to hold up the plane, especially back then, I mean, all you would need is some wires and flashing lights, and there's no flight attendant in the world that's going to...
What he did say was, I'll do the job. He didn't say, I'll blow you up. He's all nonchalant, like, I'll do the fucking job. I'll do this fucking job.
Which actually points to...
A seasoned, not criminal, maybe, because that's more...
No, I was going to say, because he said it all suave and sexy, I'll do the job, like Frank Sinatra in Ocean's 11.
That's what I'm saying. It's seasoned fucking criminal.
Yeah.
You know? Or that 70s porno I referenced earlier. It also
works
true.
The one you were in, right? Is that the one?
So is it a possibility that we're both right, that he did have a hole in the bottom of the suitcase with his penis in it, but he also escaped?
He opened the bag and it was just a Timex tied around his hog. And, you know, that scared him away.
It takes a licking and keeps on ticking, if you know what I mean.
That's it. Show's over. I'm calling it after that shit.
All right, kids, that's our thoughts. What are your thoughts at home? Do you have a certain suspect that you wish we had touched on? Do you think he's definitely dead? Do you think he's alive? John, how can they let us know their thoughts?
Well, the first thing they can do is hop on Facebook and join our discussion page. Go to Hysteria Nation. Hop on Facebook, search Hysteria Nation. Join the conversation right now.
Also, you can go to facebook.com/hysteria51pod. That's where you're going to find all of our episodes, things like that.
Yeah,
also,
just, that's just our basic page. If you like that, you'll get updates on the episode.
Also, at hysteria51pod on Twitter, where you can give us a little tweet love. And also, if you can't remember all those, go to...
That was my nickname in high school, Tweet Love.
Hysteria51.com. And while you're doing all that, leave us a voicemail.
773-669-7277. That is 773-669-7277.
And we actually have a voicemail to play. Seabot, hit him with our new voicemails.
Go with the decoder rings, guys. When in doubt, always get the decoder rings. I kind of can't even believe you need outside information on this. Go with the decoder rings. Always decoder rings.
Thank you guys once again for calling us. As you can see, you call us, we're going to fucking play it.
As is evidenced by that, we will play anything.
So wonderful, wonderful. And also a big shout out to our TeePublic page, TeePublic.com/hysteria-51. Just go to TeePublic, search Hysteria 51.
And we're seeing more and more of you picking up Hysteria 51 gear. We really appreciate it. Do us a favor. Send us a picture of you in your Hysteria 51 gear. We will prominently display it on our Facebook page. We might even put it on our website.
That is absolutely true. And you got some homework this weekend. Tell a friend about the show. Get them listening. Like we did with our good friend, Mike Gonzalez. Mike, thank you a ton for being on the show once again.
Always a pleasure.
And we are looking forward to Larkspur Underground. Now I know it's underground. I know it's some serious shit.
You heard right. The teaser during the break. We can't wait for Larkspur to come out. Mike, keep an eye out. And Hysteria Nation, we will keep you updated on when Larkspur Underground debuts.
I like it when you tease us like that, Mike. What can I say?
It's my specialty.
Makes me feel kind of funny. Like when I used to climb the rope in gym class.
Oh, boy.
So with that said, I've been Brent.
I've been John.
I've been Mike.
He's been Conspiracy Bot.
Stay woke, meet sex.
Thanks for listening to Hysteria 51, a weekly oddcast of conspiracy theories, mysteries, and the unexplained. We'll be back again next week with more known unknowns. If you'd like us to discuss a particular topic, suggest a guest, or simply seek some truth, we'd love to hear from you. You can email the show at hysteria51podcast@yahoo.com and follow us on Twitter at hysteria51pod.
You've been listening to a fourth-hand joint.